Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. My name is Paul Taylor, and I am the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. And tonight, we will press further into what has proved to be a remarkable public conversation on the leading edge of conscious culture. It is so critical that we bring higher consciousness to our world and come to more clarity about how spirituality can help us make a practical difference. These amazing Beyond Awakening dialogues are certainly moving the ball forward in a truly wonderful way. Our worldwide community just continues to grow. Over 28,000 of us have now registered to participate. It's so exciting to be engaged in such a leading-edge conversation that so many people are participating in. If you're hearing this and are not already registered, please go to beyondawakeningseries.com where you can sign up and receive the information you need to download the series introduction and our first few dialogues and receive links to participate live in the new dialogues as they take place. I want to point everyone to our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. It's updated regularly. This is where you'll find the schedule for the next several months, and you'll also find links where you can download the dialogues that have already taken place. You'll also be able to meet some of the other people who are part of our community and hear a little about their lives and the issues and the questions that they are interested in. The conversation that began there will be migrating very soon now to a brand new, really cool community site that we're really excited about. I'll be announcing more about that soon, as soon as it's ready to go live. The second place I want to point you to is our emails. That's where you'll find the links to participate live. If you don't see your email, please check your spam folder and make sure to add us to your address book. Please make sure that you're set to accept emails from Beyond Awakening Series at evolvingwisdom.com. The other way to engage is by joining our Facebook group. There you can find links and announcements, meet other members of our worldwide community who share an interest in the evolution of spirituality, and engage in ongoing discussions. Just click on the Facebook link in the email we sent you today, or go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. So it's time to introduce you to Integral Spiritual Practice founder Terry Patton, who is the host and visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Terry Patton is a vital leading voice in the field of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality. He speaks and consults internationally, inspiring, challenging, and connecting integral evolutionary leaders and institutions worldwide. A gifted communicator, community builder, a successful entrepreneur, an educator, and an author of four books, Terry has worked for over three decades as a philosopher, an activist, a coach, and a teacher, helping leaders embody higher consciousness in practical actions that transform complex systems. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. His personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Welcome, Terry.
Thanks so much, Paul, and hi, everybody. First, I want to say a big thank you to the hardworking, terrific team that pulls together to produce this event. And special thanks go to the generous sponsors who are making it possible for us to offer this to you absolutely free. I'll be telling you a little more about them in just a bit. But particularly, I want to say thank you to everybody who's listening for taking this to heart, for thinking, for caring, for holding the questions that I think are most important and holding them in seriousness and thereby creating a context where this conversation can take place, where it can be authentic, where we can ask questions that are significant and maybe come to a place where the shared understandings can have a bigger impact. At the end of this call, I'll open up the phone lines so we can, at least for a few seconds, hear one another and say goodbye. The feeling of this community has been really moving to me. Now, tonight, it's my delight to be welcoming and hosting a truly eloquent and very gracious contemporary feminine spiritual voice, spiritual teacher Gangaji, in a conversation we're calling What Are You Practicing? So far, Beyond Awakening has convened a conversation about how our spirituality can help us evolve and enable us to rise to the challenges of our time and create together a cultural context so that human beings can pull together and help engender a transition to a more sustainable human presence on this planet. A lot of us were originally inspired to embrace spiritual life because we sensed that our world was facing challenges that required at least some human beings to operate from a higher level of consciousness in order to resolve these crises. But, you know, we've had a couple of generations of serious practitioners who've been exchanging their experience, and some of us are wondering, does the way we've been doing it really deliver on that promise? Does contemporary spirituality really empower people to be activists in all the ways we had hoped, or does it help at least some of the most sensitive and intelligent among us to go inward instead of outward, and instead of helping change human culture and society, are we leaving the world in the hands of those who were less deep, less sensitive, less committed to truth? And is that maybe part of why things are such a mess? In the introduction to the series, I described the great evolutionary synthesis and how it really changes everything. This cosmic process we now realize is headed somewhere, something about more complexity and interconnectivity and cooperation and consciousness. And therefore, although we might awaken from the dream, it isn't, awakening can't only be about getting off the wheel of birth and death. Especially when we take that together with our current world crises, it at least asks us to rethink and see how much it recontextualizes our spirituality. So I've had a few conversations. I talked with Ken Wilber about the various higher states and stages of human consciousness and how we may be at the dawning of a new integral age. I talked with Michael Murphy about an incarnational spirituality based on practice. Andrew Cohen spoke with me about the ecstatic urgency of the evolutionary impulse. And in the last dialogue, Claire Zammit and I talked about a new awakening of feminine power and spirituality and how new kinds of co-creative partnership are now becoming possible between men and women. Today, I have the pleasure to be talking with Gangaji. She's a spiritual teacher in the ancient Advaita Vedanta lineage of Ramana Maharshi and H.W.L. Punja. And she travels the world seeing the unbounded radiance of being in everyone and in those who come to her. And through that, really presencing and bringing them a profound and simple message that they can stop trying. They can just stop and simply be who they already are. Born in Texas in 1942, Gangaji grew up as a very cultured and well-bred young woman in Mississippi and graduated from the University of Mississippi in 1964. She married and had a daughter. And in 1972, right, when things really began happening in a way with the counterculture, she moved to San Francisco where she began exploring deeper levels of her being. She took bodhisattva vows. She practiced Zen and Vipassana meditation. She helped run a Tibetan Buddhist meditation center. And she had a very successful career as an acupuncturist. But after engaging and succeeding in so many different life paths, including marriage, motherhood, political activism, career, spiritual practice, she didn't feel fully fulfilled. And she made a profound and in a sense, final prayer for true help. And in 1990, she went to India and met Sri H.W.L. Punja, who's often called Papaji. And that meeting really opened a floodgate in her of self-recognition. And in that meeting, her personal story of suffering ended and the promise of a true life began to flower and unfold. She's the author of the books You Are That and The Diamond in Your Pocket. She lives in Ashland, Oregon with her husband, Eli Jackson Bear, and offers retreats in the United States, Canada, England, and the rest of Europe and Australia. You can visit her website, gangaji.org, for more information. And then just speaking personally, there are many things I love about Gangaji. One is her graciousness, the intelligence, warmth, and the spacious freedom and joy that she always communicates seemingly effortlessly. She and I met in the early 90s, and she helped catalyze a transition for me in which I crossed a really important threshold just a few years after I left the ashram of my root guru, and for that I'll always be grateful to her. I also really love that she doesn't deny or suppress awareness and contact with the messiness of our human lives, and really doesn't present an idealized spirituality that ignores that. So I'm looking forward to having what I'm imagining will be a deep conversation, because Gangaji is a lovely person, but also an adventurous one. And I think maybe we can explore some of the paradoxes and challenges of contemporary spiritual life. They're not usually part of the conversation. So welcome, Gangaji. I'm really delighted to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Terry. I'm really happy to be here, be with you and all the people listening.
Well, great. Well, as you kind of got from this setup, we've been engaging in a pretty serious conversation about this moment in human evolution as a time that may require something new about our spirituality. And since you're a teacher in a lineage that's grounded in ancient Hindu tradition, and yet you're also a pretty hip contemporary woman who's totally in touch with the real experience of postmodern life, we're kind of talking about what's changing and what never changes. And, so what is what is not changing and what is changing, and what matters most about what's not changing and what is?
Well, that's so great. You mentioned Advaita Vedanta, and that is how people speak about Ramana and Papaji, but I never heard Papaji embrace any particular dogma, certainly, as his. And I believe people said that more about Ramana than Ramana. Ramana was a 16-year-old boy when he awakened, and he was raised as a Hindu, but he wasn't a particularly religious boy, and he had a profound awakening and explored that awakening internally, and it was clearly manifested throughout his life as a non-dual awakening, and that's what Advaita means to many people. And the way I understand non-dual is really the totality of life. So when you mention that I don't exclude the messiness, it's like, that's right, that's here too. So whatever is here, and formlessness is always here, and then forms arise and disappear, but they are of the same substance, which is, we can name it anything, God, consciousness, truth, essence. It's the mystery, the great mystery to me. And I'm really happy to represent that, and I would say it saved my life, meeting Papaji and discovering the possibility of opening to formlessness, certainly, because I was so fixated on form at the time that I met him, and I was really fixated on trying to capture a particular kind of form that was conceptual or idealized. And I would have experiences, great expansive experiences, but they would inevitably pass. And so I was looking for something that I could hold on to, and I thought my teacher would show me how to hold on to something. But really, in meeting Papaji, he told me to let go of everything, to lose everything, to stop trying to keep anything. And it was only in that moment of willingness to lose everything, to stop, that I discovered what's always here. And then I discovered also other things appear in that. So the state of discovery may appear and disappear. Experiences of expansion or contraction appear and disappear, but the truth of oneself is always here. And this totally freed me from my concept of my life, from my concept of who I am or who you are, who anyone is, and freed me from my concept of awakening, or freed me from my concept of practice. So that Papaji used to say, you have to take whatever the word is that has meaning and potency for you, so awakening or the future of spiritual practice and undress that word so that you aren't clinging to the conceptual formation of that word, so that you actually get to the essence of what it's pointing to. And that's what I hope to bring to people. Not to give them that, but to bring to them the possibility, the certainty that each of us is capable of discovering that for themselves.
Thank you. Yeah. It does seem like there's a paradox at the core of this conversation or any conversation in which we open ourselves to the presence of that which can dissolve the mind and then are still intending to come into direct relationship with what's changing and requires the mind to, in order for us to meet it in all its nuance and complexity, and yet not just get sucked in to our stories and our words. And, you know, and that's the spirit I hope we can engage the whole conversation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the key ideas that I've been quite moved by is that of an evolutionary view. You know, it's really only been in the last 20 years or so that we've seen enough to realize that this incredible history of cosmic evolution that we've now been able to observe through the Hubble telescope in some ways connects to the whole history of the evolution of life and biology, and that in a very real way continues in the evolution of consciousness and culture, and that in some sense, you know, all our pure sciences and natural sciences and our study of history and human culture, all they do weave together in a single trajectory, and that's almost, you know, it's kind of a stunning vision. And we're seeing that right at a time when we'll have to make choices as a whole species in order to live in a way that keeps our biosphere under our feet, so to speak. And it seems like a momentous moment that maybe even has some spiritual significance. Does it strike you that way? Do you relate to this sense of evolution as a source of inspiration in terms of the relative side of the street?
Well, I love discovering stories of evolution and recognizing how we have evolved and how we haven't evolved. And I find it very inspiring, and it's also inspiring that it's been going on long before we discovered it. And so that's also humbling, and we are continuing to make discoveries about. I mean, every time I open the paper, it seems like we discover that the universe is much older than we thought it was, or it's expanding more, it's contracting more. There are these continuing discoveries that, to me, are paradoxical in the sense that we can be empowered by that, but we also must be profoundly humbled by it, that there's so much we don't know in recognizing what we do know. And then there's, in that, the possibility to recognize there's so much more we don't even know that we don't know. And so to be conscious in the midst of that is thrilling. I mean, I find it just a thrilling time to be alive, but I really don't know where we're going. Some days it seems really good, and some days it seems like we're regressing. So I don't speak from any point of knowing that we are going to actually evolve in a spiritual way. I see very much of our past unproductive ways showing themselves in all arenas, political, spiritual, families, communities. And so in that there's a sense of no matter how we try to evolve, if we are still using the old ways of thinking and the old reliance on the conceptualization of the world, we will somehow still be following those tracks. And so I would hope that my contribution to this conversation would be the possibility that we can trust something in our mind, an aspect of my mind, of our minds, which can actually be quiet in an act way, not in a sleep way, but to actually be still and in that be fully available to discover what the potential choices are and what our choices are if our particular personal or even collective agendas are put aside. So maybe to make that a little clearer, the way I see the mind, and when I'm talking about mind, I'm in general speaking about brain function, and I'm really, to all of us in this age and in our subculture, speaking to the cognitive aspect of our minds, our thinking process, which is the lord of the realm as far as most of our world is concerned, and even our spiritual world. I think the last age of enlightenment was Descartes saying, "I think, therefore I am," and that's actually putting the concept of myself before the being of myself. And so there is that aspect of our mind, this thinking mind, and I have discovered that it either moves towards something, even something as beautiful and as true and as possible as evolution, or it fights against something, which may be the messiness of life or one's own internal messiness, or it hides or denies the fear of something. And so there's also another possibility, and that is what my teacher said to me, which was to stop, that we also have the capacity to stop, to be still, and in that to discover what is here. And obviously, when I'm speaking to people, I'm really pointing to what is always here, regardless of what we are doing or not doing, or the activity of our mind moving towards something or away from something or fighting something. But what is all of that appearing in? And from there, then, actually receiving the possibilities of evolution, the possibilities of awakening, rather than directing. I think that's really what I'm trying to say. Rather than directing it, really receiving it. Because there's another part of our brain which is open and makes no distinctions between ourselves, our bodies, and nature, and life, and each other, and is free and in love. And I believe that we as a culture have ignored that in favor of the survival mechanism of thinking ourselves, thinking our culture, and even possibly thinking what should happen for evolution. So my point is that we have the capacity to discover, and that comes from surrendering to what's here, to be quiet. I hope that doesn't end the conversation, though.
Well, you know, that's funny. I totally appreciate that. I feel like that ground in a profound surrendered presence to what's much deeper than the movements of the mind is certainly the ground of my own sanity. You know, and I'm been on the path for almost 4 years. I'm pretty founded in that as really essential. So I don't disagree in any way, and yet I always cross back and forth across this paradox that at the very first level you can have a busy mind or you can have a mind that you've relaxed, and neither of those are quite adequate to the full humanity and full civic responsibility I want to have. I do see a world in which, you know, I can see and feel for myself that I have a responsibility, and it seems that's true really for each of us, and that to engage life is part of what's necessary, and to do that we need to observe and relate, you know, to the content of things and re-engage the mind, and if we just re-inherit the egoic agendas that are so prevalent, we everything we do tends to express the contraction, the anxiety, the confusion of that level of the mind. But if we end the conversation there, as you put it, and just release the mind, we could be guilty of what some people call spiritual bypassing, you know, where we would resort to the sense of transcendence and then not really fulfill our responsibilities. And so it's a delicate thing to rest in that profundity and still not and still engage and care about this relative world that we do love.
Yes, I agree, and I deeply care. Because I, in truth, don't see any separation between this core of oneself that is at peace eternally and the manifestations that are often at war. And that's what I meant when I pointed to non-dual. I don't see a separation. I don't see it in myself. I don't see it in the world. I don't see it in my either relaxed mind or my agitated mind. And I have the capacity for both. I'm sort of a naturally agitated kind of person even. So really what I'm pointing to is, and I love your word paradox. I think it's essential. And I think that we usually are terrified of paradoxes. But really the paradox is where the polarity of our minds, which holds one side of the question as this resting in peace and with no movement, and the other side is moving toward and doing. But actually I perceive the core as some place where that is totally resolved, where they aren't separate from one another, where they are simply oneself. And I speak to people, you know, and some of them aren't aware that they've ever had a quiet moment, but I believe that every one of us has many quiet moments in a day, but because we are addicted to our thinking process, we don't even notice them. We just jump from thought to thought or paragraph to paragraph and really overlook this that connects thoughts and the thoughts are even made of. So, and I also love this word responsibility. I speak of it a lot, but I don't hold it as any kind of burden. To me, it's a natural expression of being a live, conscious human being, which is a particular power of beingness. And it's the capacity to respond. And once that's discovered, then it is not a burden. It is actually the love of life. And naturally, we want to serve what we love. We pay close attention to what we love. And when we can love all of life, the messiness as well as the pristine silence, then we can recognize really what non-dual is. And I believe we are used in that as this series that you're doing, these conversations are proof of your commitment to your love of life, as I see it. I mean, if it were just a duty, an idea, a concept of responsibility, I think that's what drives people to the hills or to the caves. So I'm not speaking of that at all. I'm speaking of the utter connectedness of silence and all of its noise, of doing and not doing. But if we are overly focused on doing or thinking or conceptualizing, which we have been as a culture, or at least for hundreds of years, we overlook what is already fulfilled. And then we are continually seeking some concept to give us fulfillment. So when you speak of being grounded in the truth of your being, I recognize that as a fulfillment, and that then this service that flows from you is simply an expression of that fulfillment. And so that's what I invite people to discover, that fulfillment is here. Whether they never reach a particular stage of anything, whether their neurosis is still intact, whether their mind is still agitated, that underneath that and in the midst of that, there is profound and deep recognition of being, self-recognition of being, and that is overflowing in fulfillment, the love of life. And maybe all creatures have it, but we as human creatures are in a particular position to recognize it. And that's, you know, why I believe beyond awakening to me means beyond the concept of awakening. So so that we can discover that awakening is here. It's really here, and we can actually surrender our concepts to that and then be used by that. Then our insights are fresh. They're not something we've memorized or learned or even that our teachers told us to believe. But they arise out of the natural, direct experience of human being with beingness as life. And I don't mean that in any abstract way. I mean that very concretely as a particular human being, an individual human being. If that makes sense.
Yeah. That makes great sense. And yet there's a... I do think there are different conversations going on within this large community that's paying attention to this call. You know, there'll be people who are, and I'm one of them. You know, I do feel impassioned as I recognize, in some sense, what I feel like I'm recognizing is that which never changes, you know, that which has been the source of all sanity in my life, you know, if it hadn't been for the grace of my guru and my own release from the incredible suffering and agitation of my born pattern, I wouldn't be able to participate in this conversation in an essential way. These would all be ideas to me. But out of that, I can feel a passion arising to participate in this realm of change with, in service, you know, of something greater than this body mind, of this larger tidal force, and I associate it with the idea of evolution. I feel like I recognize that as kind of a through line, the bigger story, and I feel inspired. Especially because we live in a time when human decisions may, you know, we may go into some crises here that could be violent enough to create cultural regression and kind of a dark age, or could be handled wisely enough that the crown jewels of human cultural development, these, you know, the... In some sense, we're among the most privileged people on the planet just to be having a conversation like this. And I love this. I want what we're able to do to continue to deepen and to go further. And I feel a kind of responsibility to be a caretaker for that, to try to bring people together such that some larger service to our world that is lit by a freer consciousness than the kind of mind that tends to determine human choices on a large scale through politics and business. You know, I want to do what I can to bring more wisdom to bear. And that feels like an expression even of my freedom, not just a bondage to an agenda or a story. What do you think of that?
I feel the same way. I feel right in alignment with that. And I live a very active life, speaking to as many people who are interested, and I support that, and I always support that in other people. I know it's not the particular path for all people, and I also have no problem with that, but I think for those people who are somehow mysteriously made for their lives to be an expression of an invitation to a bigger conversation, a celebration of the potentiality that's here, and a preparation if that potentiality does, if we do revert to a dark ages, to somehow be willing to be the light in the midst of the dark. So I am committed to that with my whole life, and I remember speaking to Papaji and expressing my life-felt gratitude, just falling at his feet and saying, how can I repay you for this? And I was really thinking of him personally. What could I do for him? Could I be his attendant? And he just laughed and he said, the only way you can repay this is to give your life to it. And I took it very seriously, and I recognized, again, that was a gift from him. In giving my life to it, I mean, I'm still a human being. I still have the human messiness. I still have opinions and still have survival issues that arise, but my life is given to this that is the source of my life. And I know that to be a great gift. I know that I individually benefit from that, and then I'm available if other people want to benefit from it. So I feel like we're right in alignment, Terry. It's just, I think language is very important. And part of our trouble, I believe, is that we somehow language things in a particular way that does give more credence to our deterministic, materialistic kind of thinking rather than to the expansionistic, inclusive opening of the mind.
Yeah. You know, this, one of the things that strikes me about this, a friend of mine put it to me, I thought, in a way that sounded very intellectually smart, that there's an involutionary and an evolutionary perspective, that the involutionary perspective would be the perspective of our great spiritual traditions, that is really all about awakening from the dream, going to the root of attention and awakening from the hypnosis, the hypnotic trance of identification in the relative, that we have that it's really all about the root involving, that is the unfolding of the relative from the ground. There's a recontacting that ground in the involutionary path, and the evolutionary impulse might be that which recognizes springing forth from that ground the what might be a different kind of urgency. Sometimes Ken Wilber has this concept, the pre and the pre-trans fallacy, it's sometimes called, that we can tend to confuse that which is pre-rational with that which is trans-rational, or that which is mm-hmm. pre-conventional with that which is trans-conventional. Almost with anything that's developmental, you know, we can think in a binary way, and that there can be two different levels of something that we could confuse that way. And maybe there's a different kind of enlightened urgency that could emerge on the basis of freedom. What do you think of the idea of a new level of urgency that might be founded in freedom rather than just bound to a more limited?
Well, I think that that's agenda. What the possibility is. That's what to me means beyond. And I know that my lineage and the way I speak to people is the involutionary way. I really direct people inside, because that's where most people feel victimized. They feel victimized by their emotions, by their stories, by the dream. And so to really plunge so deeply inside, there is a possibility of awakening. But if you really plunge completely, deeply inside, there is then no difference in inside and outside, and not as a cow or a baby may perceive inside or outside is not different, but in the recognition of the absolute appearances of differences and the capacity to also recognize that those are transparent, that they are inside as well as outside. We are outside as well as inside. And then out of simple self-love, it's quite natural that there is a passion for the outside, what was perceived as outside or what appears to be outside, to be tended in the most exquisite way, in the most careful way, in the most loving way. It's natural then, because we have discovered it to be oneself. And that to me is what non-duality means, that And it is self-love, but it's not self-love as we think of it, as narcissistic. And it may even be a spiritual bypass, because it's the capacity to immediately be at home. But it's not the spiritual bypass of pretending to be at home. It's the bypass of recognizing whatever is occurring. There is home. There is peace. There is fulfillment. And then from that, naturally, there's energy. There's capacity. I mean, I'm 68 years old, and I have to say I have more energy for meeting with people, for speaking with people than I had 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, certainly, when I was so caught up in my search for acquisition of power or rescue or redemption. So the immediate return home then just frees up attention at least, and usually enormous physical and emotional energy naturally without even doing anything except the willingness to meet what hasn't been met, to open to what we are running from or fighting, or and to be still in the midst of the impulse to reach for something. So yes, I feel that's the only true urge, is when it comes from that fulfillment. Otherwise, we are using words of awakening, but we're really trying to get something that will save us. In recognizing that fulfillment is here, you're not trying to get anything. I want the world to be better, but I'm not trying to get it to be better. I'm giving myself that it be better. It doesn't have to be better for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think that spiritual seekers have to be really ruthless in their truth-telling. I know when I was considered myself a political activist, and I was part of a nonviolent training for a demonstration, and we ended up going into jail for a while. And it was a fun, adventuresome time, and I learned a lot. And I also discovered that there was a kind of glee at us and them. Like, we were the good guys, we were the right guys, and they were the bad guys, and look how bad they are. And it was very disillusioning to me, and I actually withdrew from politics at that point for a period of time and began to be more involved in spiritual circles. And I also recognized the same thing there, a sense of, well, this is us. And so there was something that for me, and I can really only speak for myself, is that for me needed to somehow cut through the dichotomy of me and you and us and them and pre and post and advanced and not advanced and enlightened and not enlightened. It's something that had to resolve the dissonance, the cognitive dissonance of competing worldviews, because they're all there, you know. I mean, some days we are radiant in our brilliance, and some days we are just dark in our stupidity. But the resolution of that is back in the ground, which is always here, which I call home, and I also often call it the ground of being. So really that's all I'm saying. It's, I don't feel I'm in conflict with, certainly not with anything you say, Teria. I don't know, you know, about other people. I'm sure that we could take great issues. I really respect the intellectual point of view. I don't consider myself an intellectual, but I'm in awe of intellectual capacity, and I'm a student of history, and I love the new science, and I read the science page, and I'm active in my community, my politics, but that's not what's leading me. It's that's just an expression of the way this particular character is made, and there's room for all kinds of expressions. I mean, people can be hermits and be actually serving evolution. And Ramana was a sadhu who had no intentions in terms of us here in California or all over the world waking up, and yet his very commitment to being absorbed by what he had discovered did contribute to our evolution.
Yeah,
so
I sometimes say that it's not common that somebody can change the world by doing absolutely nothing, but Ramana did.
Well, how do we know? Really? I mean, that's Buddha too, didn't he? I mean, didn't Buddha have to sit there, you know, and have all of Maya come at him, demons and gods and goddesses, and not move? And so there, and I move a lot. I'm not saying that as in terms of being stationary physically, and my mind moves a lot. But for a moment it had to stop, because I was so overly identified with the object I had made of myself in my mind, and that I had made of other people, and the ongoing rearrangement of those objects of me and them and the world and the victimization of that, that it was essential for me to stop. And from that stopping, all stopping and going, all relaxation and all agitation, there's room. I guess that's what I'm saying there.
Yeah, yeah.
There's
that's
room
great.
For everything.
Well, you know, I feel that that's been very rich. We may get some more questions on that, but I'd like to move in a little bit of a different direction to talk about the teacher-student relationship. I had an exchange with you, gosh, you know, this must have been 18 years ago or something, in which I was appreciating what you were doing, and I think I mirrored back to you that what it seemed to me was going on was that you were always speaking to the awakened being in each questioner, that you were really seeing their freedom rather than seeing their limitation. Mm-hmm. And that might have, I think that's part of what's effective about your work. And you replied, no, that's the whole thing.
That's good. I stand by that reply. That's my job.
So, you know, there's a lot of controversy right now about the roles of teachers and students, and we don't surrender in the same traditional way generally that people did in India, or that the first generations, you know, when you and I were young in the past, we gave ourselves to our masters in a wholehearted, unqualified way that's not really common anymore. There have been too many scandals and stories and this is and that, and people are a good deal more wary, and I think the dynamics of students and teachers have shifted, and it may not create the same intensity of a container that it used to, which may be a disadvantage, but it may prevent some naivete and projection that was maybe not useful, so that may be a plus. I wonder if you have anything to say about the evolution of the teacher-student relationship in contemporary spiritual culture and what you see that's most exciting or most dangerous, you know, most important to notice.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because I don't really play the role of a guru. I don't feel I'm equipped for that. I'm a private person, for one thing, and I'm not interested in directing people who come to me and call themselves my students. I'm not interested in directing their lives or interfering with their lives. I feel that that's not my role, really. I have a role, and that's to be myself, share myself, and recognize myself in everyone. And yet some people call me guru, and in that they often project and idealize a way I should be, or I should act, that I should not be human. And when they recognize I'm human, they are either crushed or they're more deeply enlightened because they recognize the idealization was a concept in their mind. So in terms of myself, I watch it all unfold, and it can be heartbreaking because, of course, I fall in love with everyone I meet because I'm meeting myself and I'm in love with myself. And so when someone, you know, turns and decides that my actions are destructive to them or abusive to them in a way that I had no perception of and felt like I was absolutely non-interfering in their lives, it's shocking and heartbreaking. But to me, it's okay to be heartbroken. That's the nature of being incarnate and being totally present and involved in life. And when I was with Papaji, I can remember there was a moment where there were lots of things he did that I didn't particularly approve of. I mean, I didn't like his politics, and he definitely played the role of the patriarchal guru, and I was coming from being a liberated Western woman, so there were lots of things that weren't matches there. But I also recognized that he was offering, and I was receiving this gift that just put me to my feet, and so my surrender was absolute to him, and yet my integrity was intact too. So I didn't I didn't feel I would be sent to hell for disagreeing with him, and I did disagree with him, and I never found him to mind. I mean, he might mind it in the moment, you know, if we were having a small disagreement. But it didn't matter, because that was what was happening at the human level, at the more deep level, the level of really falling in love, because I think that's what you're pointing to. I mean, I fell in love with my teacher, and when you fall in love with someone, there is a surrender. It is out of your control. And also, an essential byproduct of that, especially in the student-teacher relationship, is that you pay very close attention to what that person is saying, what that person is pointing to, what that person is in your life. And with Papaji, I remember sort of attempting to play out some of my usual roles, like the sweet daughter, and he wasn't having any of that, or the seductive young woman, although I wasn't so young then, he wasn't having any of that. And until I finally realized all he wanted when we were together was for me just to be open, to be myself. And sometimes that could appear to me to be stupid, and sometimes it could be brilliant, but it, as long as I wasn't doing anything to get him to be somebody in particular for me, there was absolute transmission. And I find that's true with certain people in my life now. They just accept me as I am, and it's not that they worship me, but we love each other. And so I feel that they hear me more strongly. And I also know that people are very afraid of that in the world. I was just reading a book that was published in the last year. It was really advising people to only go with teachers who had psychotherapeutic training. And this was shocking to me, and it seemed like it was just a way of trying to keep the students safe. But that it also sounded like, you know, the church saying, only go to a priest for confession or absolution. And so I realized that, you know, there are these other forces. The psychotherapeutic realm is like the secular church of our time, and there is dogma there. And while it has helped innumerable people, and I have suggested people go for therapy, still, that you know, it has an influence, and part of its influence is about boundaries. And I respect boundaries, and I demand that my boundaries be respected. And yet there's a point where surrender of all boundaries and surrender of that in relationship with a teacher is dangerous, because you can get hurt. But you can also learn deeply even in that hurt, and you can discover that in the hurt and the willingness to open to that hurt and the pain of that, that you have the capacity to bear everything, and that it's actually not you that's hurt, it's your feelings that are hurt, or your emotions or your idealizations, but you are free. And so hurt itself can serve. And people would ask Papaji this question too, because I met him just when there were lots of scandals happening, and he said that there's a teacher for everyone, you know, and who's to say who that teacher is? That teacher could be famous, that teacher could be a good person, a bad person, but if it's the right teacher, there's a connection there, and you benefit in ways that cannot be judged by the current categories, and that's what I say, and I never dreamed I would have a guru here. I was never looking for a guru. I thought maybe it would be something in nature or some goddess or something. So to end up in India with a guru, an Indian man, and yet he was pointing me to what was alive in me that was the same that was alive in him, where student and guru were one. And he was pointing me to what had nothing to do with Hindu or Advaita or Buddhism or Christianity or Judaism or Islam or any of it, that it was free of, is free of all of it. And so in that, I'm still at his feet. Yeah. And so I would say maybe it's not for everybody, but I'm happy it happened to me, and I was certain it wasn't for me.
I really resonate with your desire not to see spirituality altogether sanitized, as if it could be made absolutely safe. That we take a risk if we really are interested to transcend our identity. That's big stuff, and that
yes.
might be profoundly disruptive. And the expectation that there should be no possibility of hurt in the whole undertaking is an unrealistic projection. I don't think we can. We should care about every individual and certainly never countenance anybody being hurt as if it doesn't matter. But for the individual to expect to be protected absolutely from any negative effect is not – our spirituality can't be burdened with that, or it begins to be put in a straitjacket and sanitized and reduced to something less than the fire that it is.
That's right. It's a childish wish, you know, to not be hurt. If you are going to live life fully, there is hurt. There's hurt here, and we can bear it. And we can actually, our hearts can stretch with whatever hurt appears. And we can discover that in the willingness to leap into love, wherever it happens to be evoked.
Mm-hmm. I have one other question. It's maybe a little more, you don't have to have an answer to any of my questions. You know, but let me ask this one. I asked this of you a long time ago too. This is one that I'm not sure there is a good answer to, but help me with this. I was feeling as I and I've felt this many times, but I remember it was in a satsang with you that there was an awakening that was true of me in that moment, and I could feel that there was the potential for us to be a culture of practitioners who could be responsible for a more awakened point of view, and that something new could happen, that the models that I knew from the traditions, which were mostly similar to the occasion I met you in, where a teacher sits at the front of the room and everyone relates to the teacher, you know, that if we really want to change our world, it isn't like every individual can then, you know, the model can't be that everybody gets up and sits in a room and does that. That can't be what everybody does. Somehow, it's been given to you to do that, and that's a beautiful thing. And maybe you don't know what's given to the next person. You don't have to have an answer. But I'm pondering how we can have a culture of awakening, of awakened people of all types, at all levels, you know, that there can be a version of integrity and a version of freedom that is there, you know, for butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, you know, for everybody to do in their own different way. And what would that be like? Do you see something like that possibly evolving? Do you have a sense of how we could serve that into being more fully? Do you see it emerging spontaneously? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's absolutely essential, and I do think that is occurring, that when we are willing to recognize that nothing has to change for us to discover what is true and what is here, then we can go the yogic path if that's what draws us, but we don't have to go the yogic path. We can go the psychotherapeutic route if that's what fits with us, but we don't have to. That we can recognize that nothing has to change in our lives, or everything can change in our lives, that is also secondary to what is here, then yes, I really do see that. I see that in all kinds of people. I meet with professional people who aren't going to change, being doctors or nurses or psychiatrists or ministers, and I meet with people who live very quiet, private lives, who are overflowing with this self-recognition. The issue is really how we support one another in that, how we are willing to recognize one another in that, and to, because always, you know, the mind will be active, and there's this, or my teacher said, and I absolutely trust he was correct, that we need to remain vigilant to our last breath, that the mind is made to encapsulate and even co-opt what our latest experience of truth is. And so the way we can support one another is across the board, either as teacher-student or as colleagues or as even strangers in a store, just really your willingness to be in yourself as you are living your daily life, to not practice your concept of yourself, but to in fact, live the truth of yourself. I absolutely know that's possible. I know it's happening. I don't know whether it will get to be a kind of critical mass, because it's also quite obvious that in lots of places it's not happening. I mean, I live in an area where there's a neo-Nazi organization in Medford just 10 miles down the road, and there are Christian fundamentalists around. And so I know that I'm a realist in terms of what else is going on in the world, but so what? What's our choice, you know? I mean, we can give our lives to this fully and discover then what the result is. And I know it's possible, but I don't know what the end will be. I don't need to know, because I know where my life's given, I know where your life is given, and
yeah.
I know even where the listeners to this are given. Even the ones who agree or disagree with this conversation, that's secondary or cynical about this, or it doesn't matter, because deeper than that, they are called. We are called. And that in itself remains a mystery. And we can surrender to that mystery to direct our lives or to keep us private or public. I think that's such an important thing. I'm really happy you brought it up. You know, I can remember when I had my child and I was reading Summerhill, which was about a progressive education in England, I think, and we decided we would raise her that way, and it was horrible. It was terrible, because we were totally coming from this idealized version of what it would mean to have a free child, but we weren't free. You know, we were still struggling with our demons.
One little trouble there.
You know, one little issue.
You know, there's one last thing. I really should be going to I know that there are a lot of folks who have questions for you, and I want to give them a chance to talk too, but maybe you could say a few words about this before we go to the break. I had a really interesting conversation on our last call with Claire Zammit about a new co-creative partnership arising among women, and then also between men and women, a kind of a shift perhaps in the ways that gender has played, and she was suggesting that something new could become possible. Is there anything you'd like to say about that issue as a woman who's a teacher to both men and women? And I'm sure this theme, you know, has blown through your work many times across the years.
Yes, it's interesting because, as I was saying to you the other day, you know, when I look deeply enough inside, I don't find, well, first I find a man and a woman. I mean, I have male aspects that are actually quite dominant sometimes, and yet I know what it means to be a woman and to open, but I'm sort of a young type woman. But when I go even deeper, I don't find any gender there. There's something that's free of gender. My essence is free of gender. And so there's that, and I feel like that's what I meet when I see other people, in that I really don't see a difference in men and women. And yet I recognize that we are made differently. Our bodies are different. Our hormonal surges are different, and our training and conditioning is different. And so if we are willing to first recognize where we are absolutely the same, then I think the other ways where we have been marginalized as women, you know, you simply don't stand for it as a woman. It's simply not acceptable. But it's not an issue for war. I like what you said about co-creative. It's an issue for, you know, say hello, you know, there's nothing really different in us. And as a woman, I felt some discrimination as a woman, certainly when I was with certain political circles and in certain spiritual circles, because the great icons were men. That's why I was shocked that my teacher was a man. But and even he had opinions of women that I didn't think were enlightened opinions of women, and yet he gave the transmission fully to anyone without deciding whether they were worthy or not, or male or female. So it's a mess. It's a part where it's messy, and in our willingness to meet the mess of our relationships and our internal selves, then I believe we just naturally speak the truth to each other more. And we are in this together. And
we need each other, whether we.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't. We wish we didn't. We can get into those difficult places. But yeah. Well, thank you so much, Gangaji. This has been great. I have an obligation, despite my own inclination, to keep going to take a break so that others can join the conversation. If you're listening via the web, you can go ahead and type out a concise question in the instant teleseminar window starting now. But before we begin to answer any questions, I have a few things I'd like to let everybody know about. First, I'd like to thank the presenters of this series, Integral Spiritual Practice and Evolving Wisdom. Beyond Awakening is also made possible free of charge by the generosity of our many wonderful sponsors, including the new movie called Letting Go that will entertain and delight you and exponentially guide you into uncovering and living the truth of who you are. It is designed to support the worldwide awakening to truth that is already sweeping the planet. If you are already exploring the non-dual path, then you will find its insights and perspectives enlightening and refreshing. It also gives you powerful tools to use to introduce non-duality to those around you. Letting Go will give you practical tools you can use every day to let go of the anxiety, anger, frustration, and limiting emotions that prevent you from recognizing your true nature and that cause you to re-identify with the dream. As you watch this movie, it will make you laugh and cry as it deepens your own understanding and openness to your own intuitive knowledge. To order the film, visit lettinggo.tv/moviedvd. lettinggo.tv/moviedvd. And also, the International Society for the Study of Subtle Energy and Energy Medicine, ISSEM. ISSEM welcomes researchers, healers, teachers, pioneers, anyone who's dedicated to living subtle energies as they relate to consciousness, healing, and human potential. ISSEM is a world forum for promoting understanding, exploration, research, and application of the energies of consciousness. That's ISSSEEM.org. Three S's and two E's, ISSSEEM.org. And our sisters in Evolution at Feminine Power, where evolutionary women around the world are waking up to the extraordinary and committed passion of their feminine power. Find out more about the acclaimed work of Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas and download a free 75-minute audio introduction at femininepower.com. It's titled The Keys to Feminine Power, Awakening the Three Power Bases of the New Co-Creative Feminine. Look online at femininepower.com. And finally, this coming Sunday, just 3 days from now, again at the same time, be sure to tune in for the next dialogue in this series. I'll be talking with Dr. Rick Hansen, a leading expert on the latest neuroscientific discoveries and how they inform spiritual practice. Rick is the author of the truly excellent best-selling book, Buddha's Brain. I'll be speaking with Rick at 5 p.m. Pacific time this coming Sunday on the Awakening Brain. Okay. Now let's get to the question and answer section of our dialogue here. We have, we have a question. We had a question that disappeared from my screen. I'm having a little trouble with the interface here. Pardon me.
We have
a question from Israel. Looks like a very interesting question if I hadn't lost it. Okay. Here we go. Asaf in Haifa says, Dear Gangaji, I practice and teach meditation in Israel. As a woman practitioner and teacher in a field that seems predominantly masculine, would you say there's any significant difference in the feminine experience of meditation and awakening? Do you feel that there are any necessary differences to take into consideration when guiding a woman through the practice as opposed to a man? That's kind of expanding on what you just said, but it goes a little different. Do you want to respond
to
that?
I think it's interesting because really when you're speaking then of someone learning a skill like meditation, you also have to take the body into consideration. And so women's bodies have different needs at different times of the month. They have different hormonal things, and just the recognition of that actually can serve the woman student in recognizing if there is, like, say, a pre-menstrual or premenopausal surge of hormones, that rather than believing that, they can actually open to that, and that can actually serve the meditation and the capacity to be still in the midst of an onslaught of biochemicals. So, and men, it could be different. You know, men, not being in a male body, I can't really speak of that, but I know that women are just naturally physically looser. So I always give people permission to lie down, to be comfortable, to actually tend the body rather than go against it. But I know that the more male approach is to, you know, sit straight or stand even. And that's fine if it suits the person. I think it's even more individual than men and women. It's really discovering what works for a person to release where attention is caught by the body and mind. So the spaciousness of the open mind, which is the point of meditation, can be realized by student and teacher each time.
Mm. You know, I see a couple of questions here that might relate to one another. If you don't mind, I'll read a couple of questions. You might
sure.
want to kind of weave the answers together. Lawrence in Santa Fe asks, how do we bring the intuition of what's already here out from the stillness into the full spectrum of activities? And Cheryl in Sydney, Australia asks, hi, I really love listening to both of you. Is itself doing everything through the body, experiencing, I think she means capital S, self, doing everything through the body, experiencing all, and am I just thinking I'm doing everything? Could you say a few words about this? There's a sense of just watching things be done, but that can feel like doing. I'm a bit confused about that.
Well, I would say the first part of the question is that it is already here. I mean, maybe that's the answer to the second one, too. The silence is never absent. Silent awareness is always present, whether there's activity or inactivity. Our tendency is to focus on activity, whether it's activity of mind or body or events, and simply overlook that focusing is actually coming from the source of silent awareness. So there's never an instant when silent awareness is not present. So the thought of bringing it somewhere is actually back to this issue I was talking about, that's our thinking, the thinking aspect of our mind trying to lead the show. Really the invitation is to let that follow. And when it follows, it's quiet, and then it is used through insightful thoughts, creative thoughts, fresh thoughts, but not the same old thoughts. And we know the difference. You know, one is free and fulfilled, and the other is habitual. And so it's really as we sort of titled this program, you know, what are you practicing? It's recognizing, are you practicing your habitual thoughts, and are you willing to give up that practice and be still? And then you recognize the stillness that's always here. So to be still is first an invitation for the thinking process to stop its activity. And then from that, you recognize what is here. And then in the midst of a thought, you can stop and check, is that still here? And you discover for yourself what's always present. Because we know that thoughts change, and bodies change, and moods change, and states change. But what's always here, that's reality. And I've sort of forgotten where the second question went.
She was kind of asking if the self is the one doing everything, and am I the doer, you know, or am I watching the greater doer do it through
me? Well, it's really back to what's aware of the watching. And then this doing self, me, it, this is all then mental constructs pointing to, if you are willing to undress those constructs, you discover what is always here. And doing then appears in that, and we assign a doer, because that's the way we're made. That's the way our minds are. This I am this body is a thought that arises for the survival of the body, and it's an important thought, and it's an evolved thought, but it's not the final. It's simply a thought. It's very useful, but at this point, anyone who's listening to this program has already survived. And so you have the capacity to not follow any thought of I am doing or I'm going to do or I did. Just for a moment. There's nothing really wrong with those thoughts. They aren't evil thoughts, but they cover what is here, being. So without being, there's no doing. Discover yourself as being. And then these other questions are metaphysical. You know, we could have all kinds of conversations about them, but first discover the beingness under the thought, before the thought, after the thought, in the midst of the thought.
So on the ground of that beingness, there is any doing we need, but not in a way that is somehow losing touch with that ground of being.
That's right. Thank you for saying it so clearly, dear.
That's great. Well, I want to give everybody a chance to ask questions. We had some requests. There'll be more people with questions than we'll have time for. So if you have a question, please make sure it's a question rather than a commentary and try to keep it as direct and to the point as you can and trust that Gangaji can understand it without a whole lot of extra context. And if you have a question, please raise your hand by pressing *2 on your telephone. So people who are calling in by phone can press *2 to raise your hands. So please go right ahead and do that. And we'll see if we have some questions here in a moment. I don't see any right away. Here we have, I'm not sure about the name. This is someone from Watsonville, California. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Judith.
Hi, Judith.
And I was just, I guess my question is basically if the community is aware of a teacher who's sexually exploiting students, what do you think needs to be done?
Well, the teacher needs to be confronted, clearly, you know, needs to stop.
Is there more you want to ask about that, Judith, or is your answer complete?
Well, I guess I was trying to make a real concise question. I guess I'm just aware that too often communities seem to not really do much to stop that sort of thing, and so I'm not sure how.
So is this a community you're in right now that you're actually involved in, or is it more theoretical?
Well, it's sort of, I'm an Episcopal deacon, and I'm also a survivor of abuse, and I've just seen the way the church has dealt with, I know a lot of other survivors, and I've seen the way the church has dealt, especially when people have been exploited as adults by teachers. Or clergy, and
it takes a lot of courage, doesn't it? Because there is this assumption of authority, and it feels as though you almost have to risk your life to raise your voice, and so it really is a courageous matter to raise. But then, you know, there's other dynamics that can creep in where there have been occasions where people have been accused of sexual misconduct falsely, and we now have something of maybe a hypersensitivity to this issue where the dynamics can work poorly and not only in one direction.
Yeah, I think communication is the key here, and really what you were saying, Terry, about you feel as if your life is at risk, in that very moment, this is a real spiritual issue. And so to be willing, maybe for you to take it on yourself or with a friend to go to this teacher and at least let the teacher know this is what is being said and that it's not acceptable, you know, and then to see where it goes.
Well, I guess, in terms of my own situation, I've done that and watched the church not do anything.
Yeah.
So that's where it's very difficult.
Sure. Yeah.
It's really difficult.
Yeah, because they have been confronted and acknowledged that it happened, and basically,
well, then it,
they've
it,
been allowed to continue.
It really takes creative engagement in a way. There are no sort of formulaic answers to a problem like that. How does one creatively engage? Do you withdraw? Do you find a way to raise your voice more loudly or work creatively behind the scenes? It's a situation that calls for one's whole being and for really an integral and heartfelt response, don't you think, Gangaji?
Oh, and I think that this is indicative of so many situations like that. I mean, slavery is still happening in our world, and the horrors that happen in the Congo, I mean, to women, there are so many horrors, and as you say, they're happening in a very civilized place and a respected institution, and in that sense, it's happening everywhere. It's happening in every neighborhood in the world, and so to somehow recognize it is part of what we are in, and to then discover how we can play a productive role, and also, as you have recognized, it may not make a difference, it may not change. And in that, there can be, that's a heartbreak right there. But you can open to that heartbreak, and you can maybe discover from that a more creative, as Terry was suggesting, a more creative angle, a more creative approach. And that's the discovery process, because we know, I mean, authority often does not give up its power, and its power is often abusive in many ways, subtle and gross, and this is a very common way.
Thank you so much, Judith.
Good luck, Judith. Thank you.
We have a question, I think, from the UK. You're unmuted and on the air. Please go ahead.
Hello, Gangaji.
Hello.
It's Kathy Stevens from the UK.
Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I was on the Keys to Awakening and Freedom course.
Oh, good.
And I had a very, I'd like to ask a question and also just make a quick commentary about the relationship between teacher and student, that I, on the Keys course, but I made a very strong connection with you right at the very beginning when I first met you. There was an immediate heart contact that like I felt I'd always known you. And it was just something that occurred almost like sort of whether I liked it or not, you know. I mean, I love you, and I think you're completely wonderful, and you're kind of my type, you know. But it was kind of beyond that. And when at the end of the course, when I on the last meeting, I was describing actually meeting my negativity in a very, very deep way, and just in a very determined way, and just carrying on with it. And you said, this is where we meet. And that was very profound, and it was like a cord went between us, and that cord has just kind of got stronger and stronger, you know, since the course, and it's just an extraordinarily moving, I can't describe how moving and exciting and just joyous thing it is to just feel this teacher-student connection, and it starts, then it becomes kind of beyond Gangaji. It's like connecting to the cosmic teacher, as it were.
Yes, that's beautiful. Thank you. I'm honored that you use me in this way, and and that you fall so deeply into that connection that it is the cosmos. That's the truth. The cosmos is undeniable, uncontrollable, and irresistible.
Yeah. And, you know, I just, yeah. Oh,
yes.
Thank you. The other thing I wanted to say, which is probably a slightly more sort of intellectual question, and I just wondered if you would be able to talk for a moment on your view of the relationship between awareness and attention.
I think you did you write me this before?
Just
did
now, yes.
Attention is a word I use. It maybe you could even say focused. You know, it's where our mental attention is located. So if we have our attention on our problems, we are very aware of our problems and we're suffering. If we have attention on this ground of silence, then we are at peace. But attention is rooted in awareness, and
yeah.
Awareness is the ground.
Yeah. It's
Kathy, there are some others who'd like to ask questions. I really appreciate your question, and thank you. I think it was very rich, but I'd like to acknowledge Raghunath Murthy in Kissimmee, Florida. You are on the air.
Oh, hello, Gangaji.
Hello, hello.
My question, I was trying to formulate it so that I could really articulate what I mean. I would love to refine my ability to surrender to that stillness. I didn't expect tears to come up, but it really matters to me. I guess I'm trying to get it right, you know. But to surrender to that stillness, in fact, one of my absolute favorite YouTube clips of you, there was a period of time I would get up every day and I'd watch it first thing, which is, what's my core message? And I absolutely adore that. And the difference between an experience or a sensation of giving my power away,
mm-hmm.
let's say to something external, when I have a reverence for it or a respect, even in function of somebody that I would have called, you know, a guru or a spiritual teacher, and acknowledging that obviously they are further along on the path than I am, but at the same time, I have a sense that I've almost abdicated a responsibility for, you know, always me being in charge of every breath and every step, and just like you were saying, wherever I place my attention. And I'm wondering if you could address that.
Yeah, so I think that's a very, really a good question, and it relates to what Terry and I were speaking about, the teacher-student. So, I mean, I did surrender to my teacher, but I surrendered really to what he was offering. I surrendered my attention to what he was pointing to, and because he was a true teacher, he was pointing me back to what was true to myself. And I discovered in surrendering to that the reverence I felt for him, the joy I felt in his presence, was evoked really out of this very special relationship of his offering awakening to me. And so there's a lot in our lives that evoke that, and some of it we shouldn't give our attention, you know, we could go to a movie and it can evoke joy and bliss, but if we begin to worship that movie, it's misplaced. If we recognize that something was evoked, anything passing by could evoke it, where does it come from? So it evokes what's already here. And the way I use the word surrender is really to open the mind. And the only thing that stops us from opening our minds is really fear. Fear that we will lose something. Fear that we will lose something we've accumulated. And so the willingness to lose everything just in an instant, then the mind is free of its possessions. And that in itself is surrender. And, you know, the fact that when you said the word surrender to silence and tears started coming, so you yourself evoked it in that moment. all that's necessary is to recognize it's already alive in you. It's not a dead silence. It's the alive. It's life. It's silent life before it's manifest in thought and word and deed. And so it's already present. It already moved you to tears. And if you tell the truth, it's actually already leading your life. So it's surrendering to what is actually already here, that has already captured your attention, your love. You love it. So you surrender to that love. You know it can be deeply challenging, but it is always simple. It may be really hard because we may have enormous fear, but it's really simple. You surrender to love. Not
yeah.
as an object, but as the presence of your being.
Yeah, yeah. The words I keep on hearing as I was listening to you, and tears have just been flowing down my face.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That was such a beautiful answer, yeah. Well, thank you so much for your call.
Thank
I realize we've gone a little over time, but we'll all be able to say goodbye to one another in just a few minutes. Let me complete our call now by, well, just thanking you again, Gangaji. This has been a really lovely time that we've spent together. Thanks so much.
Oh, I thank you too, everyone. I'm always just moved and blessed by everyone's presence.
Well, wonderful. Well, before I tell everybody about what's coming up next, a few reminders. If you're interested to dive deeper into the conversation, be sure and check out our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog or our Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook, or just search for Beyond Awakening on Facebook. And you're invited to post comments about this dialogue or further conversations you want to extend. And also, if you have suggestions for questions for Sunday's dialogue with Dr. Rick Hansen, the psychologist and expert on applying the findings of the new neuroscience to the everyday matters of using our minds and hearts to change our brains. I'll be speaking with him at 5 p.m. Pacific time this Sunday on the Awakening Brain. And finally, if you or anyone you know might be interested in this series, please forward them one of our emails so they can join us too, or invite them to register at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you want to learn about my own work, I'll be doing some seminars starting in about 10 days in Germany and also be in Sweden. Please visit my website, integralspiritualpractice.com. And finally, I want to thank some of the partners and sponsors who've made this all possible, especially Boulder Integral. Do you have an important idea or project in your life that needs a jump start? Maybe it's the new business you've dreamed of starting or an important initiative for your job or company. Perhaps it's a creative project like writing a book, a blog, or a screenplay, or maybe you'd like to press reset on your career and develop an entirely new vision for yourself. If so, consider attending the Integral Incubator, a 5-day boot camp in Boulder, Colorado, where you'll work with Ken Wilber, Jeff Salzman, and an expert team of Integral coaches to make your dream a reality. Find out more about the Integral Incubator at integralincubator.com. That's integralincubator.com. And New Dimensions Media. You'll want to check out New Dimensions to hear some of the leading point writers of the world, such as Alice Walker, Dr. Andrew Weil, Gene Houston, Bill Moyers, David White, as they address a wide range of topics, including health and healing, science, eco-activism, social change, and spirituality. Find them at newdimensions.org. And also by our dear friends at Integral Enlightenment. Integral Enlightenment is an authentic contemporary approach to spiritual practice designed to bring about a total transformation of our humanity. Founded by evolutionary pioneer Craig Hamilton, Integral Enlightenment seeks to revitalize the spiritual path to meet the evolutionary needs of humanity in the 21st century. Integral Enlightenment is a path for those of us who know deep down that spiritual life is about much more than our personal happiness or contentment. It's for those of us who feel compelled to transform ourselves in order to serve the greatest calling there is, the further evolution of life, humanity, and consciousness itself. To find out more about the work of Craig Hamilton and Integral Enlightenment, please visit integralenlightenment.com. And don't forget to tune in this Sunday in just 3 days Dr. Rick Hansen will be bringing his deep engagement with the practical implications of contemplative neuroscience to discuss the awakening brain. Neuroscience offers a wonderful operating manual for our brains. With that and the toolbox of things we can do inside our brain, we can use our mind very skillfully and effectively to change our brain gradually over time, which will then change our minds over time in genuine ways. Only in the last 10 years or so have we had enough information in brain science to make this kind of dialogue possible. And then on Tuesday, I'll be talking with Catherine Woodward Thomas, the teaching partner of Claire Zammit, on evolving together, why we need each other to become ourselves fully. Please note that this one is on Tuesday next week instead of Thursday, still at 5 p.m. So mark your calendars, please. And finally, I would like to thank you all for joining me, and we can open up the phone lines so that we can all hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Thank you, everybody, for joining me. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks so much.
That was great.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was great, wasn't it?
Really beautiful.
That felt good hearing everybody. Thanks so much. It was really lovely to spend this time with you.
Oh, I felt the same way. Thank you, Terry.
All right. Have a wonderful evening.